personal things. And always this teaching is a contemplative or reflective teaching. It's not like words are absolute. So somehow you have to find the words which fit you. These are the words which fit me. So obviously that's why I talk in that way. When you read and study Buddhism, you get these kind of set pieces, like you get morality, generosity, and wisdom, and constant meditation. In meditation you get words like samatha vipassana, concentration and insight. And then you get words like anapanasati and metta, mindfulness of breathing, and compassion. So this kind of set pieces which intellectuals set up for you. Of course, life isn't a set piece. You know, you read all that and you think, oh, I understand all that, and then life comes along and it's much different. And that's the way the structures have to be, don't they? They're kind of simplified things. So one has to always, obviously if I have a firm understanding of the whole project, I like to call it the Buddhist project, why the Buddha taught what he taught, and why meditation is important and morality is important and so on, then one is coming from a ground of wisdom rather than just sort of preconceived Buddhist notions which one should be doing. So just like, say, generosity. We say, be generous, right? But I can be generous I can give you something with the hope that you'll give me something back, right? I can be generous, I can give you something with the hope that you'll praise me. You know, I can be generous from a manipulative mind. I can be generous because I really love you and it's a joyous thing to give. I could be generous because, well, it's an old shoe anyway, you might as well have it. Right? So what's generosity? And yet, you know, we say be generous. What is generosity? And so on and so forth. So what we're always looking at in Buddhism is what's the underlying heart of the matter? You know, where am I coming from? What are my intentions? Why am I doing what I'm doing? And what is the result of that? Is it a good result? Is it a bad result? Does it lead to my peace, the peace of my community? Is it helpful, not helpful? And not seeing those underlying energies and intentions and attitudes, if I don't see that, then I can never really understand the results of my life, of my actions, of my speech and my thoughts, because I'm not really seeing where I'm coming from. And so in meditation, I might have the idea that, yeah, to meditate is good and so on. But if I'm coming from a wrong attitude and wrong energies and maybe wrong willfulness or whatever, then the results won't be good. And I'll either go back to the drawing board and check out how I'm doing it, right? Or I'll give up because it's not working, one or the other. Hopefully go back to the drawing board. Or I'll think I'm useless, and I'll keep trying. And I just keep trying. Just watch the breath, you get enlightened. Just keep going. And I'll maybe do it for 20 years and think, I just can't meditate. So always what we're not just kind of doing some exercise that the Buddha recommended or some teacher recommended or whatever, but we're seeing, where are we coming from? How are we doing this? So I began this little exercise in meditation with the suggestion that right effort in any kind of our practices is not from a kind of willfulness to get something or to get rid of something. So it's not coming from greed or aversion. Because if it's coming from greed and aversion, the very underlying energy there is not peaceful. And the whole teaching is about realizing the end of tension, the end of this. And, you know, this kind of desire to get or become or get rid of, this need to control or become. So that if I can, first of all, if I can understand what that is, if I can understand what the awake mind actually is, not just the intellectually, because the intellect is not insightful. Intellect comes afterwards. Insight is more intuitive, more visceral, more aso. When I really notice something and I understand something, it's not because I thought so much about it, because I saw it or I knew it in a different way. So actually feeling what right effort is like, rather than having an idea about it. And so my suggestion here with the listening is that, like, when you listen to sound, can you get to, first of all, pure presence? In other words, you're not thinking about the sound. Can you get to just that, just listening? Where the mind isn't making comment, isn't making judgment, so there isn't a kind of whole filter of thought going on. That's the first step, to be present. And then can I listen and just accept the sounds that are there? So the mind is attentive, but in the listening there is no desire to get a sound or to get an experience by listening, and neither is there the effort to get rid of anything. Even trying to get rid of thought doesn't work, because it's still aversion to thought. So it's just pure listening. Now I use that as a way of establishing right effort. And I can always do that. If I'm meditating or I'm walking through the street, or I can always listen. And then in that listening I can remember what right effort is, or right awareness, right attention, or right attitude. Different ways you might want to talk about it. And then if I get a feeling for that, and it's a feeling, okay, not a thought, if I get a feeling for that, then I can perhaps remember that attitude when I apply my mind to the object of meditation which I'm using. Yeah? It doesn't really matter what I use. I mean, it does matter. But if I get the attitude right, and then I can sustain that attitude or that kind of listening quality on the object of meditation, then I begin to have mind moments of clarity, mind moments of right effort, mind moments of wakefulness, mind moments of presence, and those mind moments build up. Like Ajahn Chah would say, it's like if you turn with meditation, you kind of turn the tap on and you get drip, 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 and then as you get stronger in meditation, the drips, drip, 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 until you get a flow of water. And you find that if you're beginning meditation, you know, you kind of notice you're in the room every 5 minutes. And then the mind goes off. You get kidnapped, and you're thinking about this or that, and then someone coughs or there's some pain, and then you're back again. And the important thing is not to sort of hate yourself for thinking too much, or just willfully, I'm going to watch that breath for the whole in-breath. I'm not going to let any thinking come, because that won't work. But just keep realizing what that right attitude is like. Keep remembering, this is what it's like. Establish that first. If you establish that first, then that becomes a kind of power in the mind. You begin to recollect or remember what right mindfulness is, or right effort, or right awareness. Yeah? But if one doesn't establish that in the beginning, and one is just trying with a kind of willfulness to dominate the breath and not think, you just have terrible results and you won't want to meditate. So getting right effort, getting right attitude of what the awake mind is. You'll notice that in nature, maybe, you know, you're walking through the arboretum, almost killing myself on the ice there. Just the sound of a red-winged blackbird. It's full of red-winged blackbirds, and just the sound just awakens me. And it's not just about red-winged blackbirds. It's like noticing, this is the awake mind, this is the present mind. And as you kind of recollect that and remember that, you tend to be able to return to that more often. Huh? Tend to be able to return to that more often. So then you try to sustain that in meditation. So you have quite deliberate exercises: one in breath, one out breath. Another suggestion, these are things that I use. I find, say, if I'm working with the breath, if I say, let it come to me, which sounds a bit silly, well, who's it going to come to, right? So if you start to think about that, what does he mean, come to you? What is this, his breath? You just start to think. Usually with meditation instruction, you don't think about it. You hear it, let it all go, and then it sort of bubbles up. But in this suggestion, what I find, when I say that, let it come to me, I don't kind of reach out and try to do something about the breath, and it makes me very still. I find it really helpful for stillness. And that's what we're trying to establish stillness and then sustain that stillness, but keep awake. I noticed someone was very relaxed over this side of the room. and that we don't want to do. because that's too relaxed. So this is the problem you get. You either get too much energy, you feel restless and you try too hard, or you get too dull and your mind just slips off into sleepiness. And the only way you learn about that is by just doing it. Just practicing, practicing, practicing. But do contemplate that. When, like, if I sit here and I just like let the color of the wall come to me, and my mind goes still. But if I'm looking, how many bricks are there? Are they bricks? And why yellow? And my mind starts to think, it starts to judge, it starts to find something. So if we're doing that with the breath, we're trying to find a peaceful experience, then we'll always be sort of out there in tension. But if we just sit home, as it were, and let the breath come to you, you'll find there's great stillness in that. At least I find that, great stillness. And then the brightness is really noticing the body, really being in the body, feeling the breath in the body, if you're using the breath, really noticing what the chest feels like or what the belly feels like. It's very physical. And the difficulty is there that so many of us are intellectuals who work a lot on computer screens and think a lot and plan a lot and regret a lot and think a lot. So you've got this kind of difficulty of a lot of mental activity. And that's obviously in an intellectual culture where thought is used a lot. It's just a difficulty which we're all going to face. So one thing I find very helpful in meditation and life in general is when I'm thinking, my head gets tense. Because all my, you know, if I'm thinking heedlessly, if I'm thinking deliberately, it's different. But if I'm just kind of fantasizing, it doesn't have to be a kind of worrying thought. It's just thought is up there. And I can feel it. I can feel it in my eyes. I can feel it in my, wherever, all around the face. So what I find is if I just relax the facial muscles and really see what does it mean to be down here in the hara or in the heart or in the throat, and then I can see the energy all going up into the head and thinking. Like depression, very kind of foggy in the head sleepiness and all those things. But if you bring it down here, you're in the body, you're much more in the body, you're not in thought, you're really feeling that. And if you, what I find also, then if that becomes a kind of a way of being aware, okay, being aware in the body, and this, our culture, I think, really needs this, because we, especially in a Buddhist culture, I find people have a lot of opinions about Buddhism, a lot of clever opinions about Buddhism, but they often don't know where their breath is. Or their heart, you know, where's the heart? So there's a kind of overemphasis, obviously, on thought, and yet it's a good tool. Thought's a good tool. Analysis is a good tool. So if one looks at this whole part of the Buddhist project, the meditation, as a training, right? As a training in stillness, as a training in presence, and as a training in body awareness. Just those simple things. They're very simple things, but actually quite a challenge, I think. But if you do that, if you keep training in that way, then you begin to be really present to how life is manifesting for you. And you're really present to it because you're not in a kind of disassociated thought form about it. There's a whole difference, say, feeling. I was at the university the other day and someone was asking me about loneliness. There's an enormous difference between feeling lonely and thinking lonely thoughts. Isn't it? I mean, there's an enormous difference. And thinking lonely thoughts won't get you out of loneliness. It'll probably make you a lot more lonely. Right? Distraction will get you out of loneliness for a little bit. But then it usually comes back, doesn't it? But how do you go beyond something like loneliness? So that was a question the person asked me. And this is the kind of challenge of Buddhism, is to go to the heart of the stress that we're having, to go to the very heart of these very real sufferings that we have as human beings, and enter into them in a kind of visceral way, in a heartfelt way, in a breath way. And so I think the reason the breath is stressed in all the Asians, all the religious practices that come from India, is because the breath registers all these things. The breath registers loneliness, it registers dullness, it's all there. And if you become kind of conversant with the breath channel, what you'll notice is the attachment to these self-disparagements or worries or loneliness or anger or greed or whatever it might be, you quickly notice them in the breath channel and you can quickly relax them out of there. And you begin to be able to have a practice which both brings you to the present moment and purifies those very feelings which continually bring us into modes of suffering. So like this student, I said, well, you just have to go right to it. You have to go to the loneliness. How do I do that? Well, you just have to go to it. And how do you actually go into loneliness? Well, not you don't really go into loneliness by thinking lonely thoughts, do you? Or analyzing it. That's not really awareness of loneliness. I can think, well, I'm lonely because, you know, I'm not where I should be, or because I'm 54. But that's not loneliness. That's a thought, isn't it? It's not really the feeling of loneliness. So if one has a meditation practices where one can be aware of life in a way other than thought, one can still use thought. I can use thought and say, ah, this is loneliness. That's right thought. Wrong thought is, oh, poor me. I'm lonely. That's wrong thought. Or I've got a problem. I'm lonely. Not a problem. It's just loneliness. Loneliness feels this way. So if I say, yeah, loneliness, and then I have a kind of, again, like a hyperlink which takes me to the body, and I can go really into that loneliness. Now, the difficulty there is desire. Because who wants to be lonely? You don't want to be lonely. You want to be happy. So, okay. Get a new relationship. Fine. Or a new puppy or whatever you want to do. But when you feel lonely, there's other ways of working with it. And that is like to go against unfulfilled desire. And the whole Buddhist training around the Four Noble Truths is like to really begin to challenge this desire in the heart which seeks fulfillment in an externality. It's fine to do that. It's fine to have relationships and communities. And I love communities and live in communities. They're very, very helpful. But to find that true refuge in the heart, one has to begin to see that the Buddhist teaching is saying that the purity of the heart is something in here rather than out there. And what desire does, desire is always looking for a solution outside by blaming, by going into thought, by distraction. But then coming home and seeing, oh, this is what loneliness feels like. Why is that difficult? Because the desire mind won't want to look at that. Right? I don't want to be with loneliness. But if you can go against that desire mind and really just feel it, then you begin to experience the purification of mind. Sure, the loneliness comes up, but now it's known as an object of consciousness, just like the breath. And it's known in pure awareness rather than with desire. And its energy comes for a while and then ceases. And the happiness of that, the freedom of that, is different than a happiness of compensations, of distractions, because the heart has been liberated from suffering, right? And this is this idea of liberation, not a kind of experience you get, but a kind of a practice that you do, and then you begin to see that. It's like a yoga posture. You do the yoga posture for a while, and then you finish the yoga session, unless you've really kind of pulled all your muscles or something, you walk away and feel, God, that was nice. Huh? That felt good. And that's the kind of what purification in the Buddhist sense is like. By witnessing to something like, I'm just giving an example, loneliness, going against the desire to just to run away from it, letting it be there, it goes through consciousness and you feel, oh, the mind's free of that. That's very, very much against the kind of worldly stream of distraction and entertainment. And I've got a loneliness problem. You don't have a loneliness problem. Loneliness is just what it is, just that way. So getting back to meditation, if I can listen to sound with right effort and no desire, right? In other words, if I can be present without desire, without all the judgments and trying to become and trying to get rid of, if I know what that is then, and then I train with breath or body posture or yoga or whatever I do, I train in that kind of awareness, right? Then that gives the power of my mind to be, when loneliness does come into consciousness, to be with loneliness without desire. Because then there's right effort. Because I've cultivated right effort. And then I really, and that's one thing that if you have a chance, if life is not hunky-dory for you at odd times, and you're feeling something, if you can just go into that and look at the desire rather than the emotion, because that's the trick of Buddhism. Loneliness is not suffering. It's the attachment to the desire not to have the loneliness, which is the problem. In the Four Noble Truths, the Second Noble Truth, First Noble Truth, there is suffering. Okay? So what does that mean? It says, there is suffering is a statement of Dharma rather than self. In other words, I'm feeling lonely is not Dharma. Oh, poor me is not Dharma. Or, I shouldn't be lonely. Or, that's not Dharma, that's ego having a loneliness problem. Whereas Dharma is, there is suffering, is saying, this is loneliness feels this way. So you're making a kind of dharmic statement. Loneliness feels this way. You're beginning to see loneliness as an object of mind, getting out of the storyline. Second Noble Truth, there's a cause of suffering. That cause of suffering is attachment to wanting. It's not the loneliness. It's not the fear. It's not the anger. Those are karmic formations which we just have to work through. So when loneliness pops up into the heart, that in Buddhism, that's not the problem. Karmically, you could see, well, okay, that comes up because, someone's died in my family and so on and so forth. Naturally, those things happen. But the problem in the moment, in the existential moment, is not the loneliness, it's the attachment to the desire not to have this unpleasant experience. And that's the real key to Buddhist insight, vipassana, is to see that this is the way it is now, this feeling is the way it is now, and what's the real problem? It's the attachment to the craving. It's the tanha, upadana in the Pali. And if you see that, that leads to the third noble truth, is that the freedom from suffering, the liberation of the heart, nirodha, is the abandonment of craving. Right? So how do you abandon craving around loneliness? You say, okay, come on in for 20 years. You say, you can stay here. You welcome it because you want to get rid of it. Right? You welcome that which you want to get rid of. But, on the other hand, if you start just fantasizing, you know, owning a new MP3 player, is that what they're selling now? they keep selling something new, don't they? And you start to fantasize about that, entertaining yourself, oh, that'll be nice if I have that. That, you say, no, I might die tomorrow. You have a different strategy for different kinds of attachments, right? As your mind starts to entertain that beautiful thing which you're going to do next year, that's just to eating too many mental ice cream cones, isn't it? Lick, 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 kind of thinking. And then you say, yeah, but what if I died tonight? Kind of wakes you up, and you come back to the moment. That's renunciation. So you have different kind of suggestions in Buddhism. You have renunciation, you have metta, depending on what you're getting up to. Because if you understand this whole, especially around craving, like if you can really see that, it's not, I'm doing a lot of sitting with my mom, it's great. Having a mom who, with a big flat and having nothing to do. I forget what it was. It was some kind of, probably the usual trying to get enlightened trip that monks get up to. But it really, what is it? It's the craving. Look at the craving. Look at the craving. And just keep on that. It's very uncomfortable, but just know that. And then the heart's free. And that's what many people don't see. They think it's the anger that's the problem. It's the fear that's the problem. And then the mind goes into the storyline. And then the storyline goes for a while. And then you hate yourself for having a storyline. And it gets very convoluted, right? So what to do? Come to the body. If you've got something very, very simple like that, come to the body, and then use thought and say, what do I want now? Or even better, what does wanting feel like? And then feel it in the body, right? Do that with simple things like like so many people find it very difficult to be in the present moment. So the mind goes future past, right? So you're meditating and, you know, the mind will be thinking about the future. What you're going to do, who you're going to talk to, and da-da-da-da. Then do something very simple. Just say, how does future feel in body? Forget it, you know, make it very simple. Like, what does future feel like in the body? Because you'll find the body's registering that. This constant movement to the future. What is it like in the body? And you'll find tension there, the craving, and you just keep using the body as your monitor. Then you'll find how the throat gets tight, like if it's anxiety, you'll find it down here, and you'll be able to keep relaxing out of it. And that's both purification and developing the virtuous qualities. So you got to go, you know, you got to really see what the problem is and what the project is in Buddhism. Right? The problem is the attachment to craving, and the project is the abandonment of craving, no matter what the experience is. At a social level, the project is to do good, refrain from doing evil, and be responsible. Right? So that's the social project. And then the inner project is very simple, craving and the abandonment of craving. So you have to understand that. And it, intellectually, okay, you need a bit of that, but what does craving feel like in the body? So you're sitting in meditation, let's you get pain, discomfort. Use a chair if you want, fine. Use a bench if you want, fine. Use a super wedge like I have if you want, fine. Right? But you still have pain. You still have discomfort. So once you've done everything you can with your sitting technologies, right? And then you decide to sit, then when discomfort comes up, see what you do with it. Because it's a really contemplative, reflective teaching. It's not just willfulness. So when I began meditation, I just kind of held my posture for an hour. Big deal. Kind of sort of limp out. And you know, I'd feel like I conquered my body. But I wasn't happy. So there's that. There's that extreme of just willfully holding the posture. The other extreme is just to kind of, well, I have to be kind to my body. Fidget. You know, you just move. Oh, my body's feeling a bit of pain. Move. And you get no peace from that. You'd just be bouncing around. Okay, so those are the extremes of reacting to any niggling little discomfort and being some kind of heroic fool who doesn't shift the posture. Those are the extremes. Middle way is, okay, reasonable. I could probably sit for 5 minutes. I'll try 5 minutes. Right? And then when the discomfort comes up, what's the craving there? Right? What is the wanting? Get a hold of the wanting. Not intellectually. What does wanting feel like? And pain is very good for that. And it's a reasonable kind of pain. You know, it's not life-threatening. You're going to survive the 5 minutes. But then the whole exercise becomes very, very edifying because you're really looking at craving now. You're looking at what the Buddha was talking about. And if you can get an insight around bodily discomfort, then that informs the heart at a heartfelt way about what the problem is around loneliness or fear or whatever it might be. Because it's insightful, it's not just intellectual. Once you understand around the body, you begin to understand around emotions. But if one misunderstands the project and one is always just trying to kind of, like Ajahn Suchito says, rearrange the deck chairs on a Titanic, you know, if you're just, you're trying to shift to one state to another state, it's not it. Because the deepest peace of Buddhism isn't a kind of a pleasant experience in the normal way. You know, like having an ice cream cone. It's a deep silence which underlies all of this movement. Right? And as long as we're kind of reacting to the movement with pleasure and pain, we're kind of looking in the wrong place. And the way we're reacting to pleasure and pain is through craving. So the Buddha's saying, get this right. It's not the experience of pleasure and pain. It's this craving for comfort, for happiness. This kind of movement out, always out looking. And you come home in this kind of receptive knowing. And then you notice that movement out all the time. The reaction to the body, the reaction in thought, the difficulty with emotions. And you say, can I just receive that? Can I just let this loneliness come to me? And then going out there with thought and fixing it or whatever. Can I let this feeling of annoyance, just come to me. And you begin to find this kind of this witnessing in you, which is very still, very peaceful. Now loneliness isn't, you know, it's moving all the time. But so is everything else, isn't it? And that's why we talk about change. That which changes comes and goes, and underlying it is this clear knowing, clear witnessing. And so the kind of training in Buddhism is like to take little exercises like the breath, and not just kind of getting some neat meditative experience that you had once. It's not that. It's a training. So if you're training in right effort, in right mindfulness, two good things to train in meditation is adhittana, determination, and patience. Take those two. Say if you're just beginning meditation and you find like sitting 20 minutes on your own difficult, good. Set your clock for 15 minutes and use that as a training in just determination. Just say, okay, I might move 120 times during this 15 minutes, but I'm going to stay here. Stay on the cushion. Not through willpower, just what I'm going to do. And the mind starts to negotiate. Oh, come on, 10 minutes. No. Sorry. And you watch all the kind of negotiating going on. And the rationalizations, well, you really need to check your email, you know, blah, blah, blah. And no, 15 minutes. And you use that as a training in determination, not just willfulness, no, just 15 minutes. And you build that up. Or a training in patience. Okay, so my mind's thinking, but back to the breath. Yeah, I can't do this. Yeah, but back to the breath. Patience. So if you see that, and I find this word training very helpful, that you say, okay, I'm training in just being on the cushion for 20 minutes. Or just being patient with a whole in-breath or a whole out-breath. Then usually you're not trying to get an experience, because you're just training. You're just doing this for training. That you can do. But if you go into it thinking, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that, I'm going to get that experience, you're already with desire. And then you feel frustrated. Whatever it is. So these are like, this is what we call sammasankappa in the Noble Eightfold Path. Right thought, right attitude, the intentions you put into this. You know, what suggestions do you make? Because that's what's going to set up your meditation. And then if one's meditation is in line with the path, then all the factors that you develop in the meditation are factors which should be clicking into ordinary life. You know, it shouldn't be separate. It should be all making the whole spiritual work more powerful, because you're developing all the factors which are right, which are kind of right practice. This we can do. I think, you know, in little ways, you can sit for 15 minutes, no matter what your mind says. Unless the house is burning, then move. But, you know, these are kind of possible things. But if you're just trying to get some kind of really neat experience, really deep silence, no thought for 2 hours, and you just feel frustrated. So make it kind of a reasonable thing. And then you build on it. You keep building on it. And then it also is a kind of project which is kind of neat. You know, it's not like you're always failing. Oh, God, I can't meditate. I know my mind was just all over the place, blah, blah, blah. No, it's all right. I sat there for 15 minutes. I developed more patience. So the whole thing becomes much more possible. All right? Any questions around those ideas? Questions, Greg. Oh, yes.
How long do you have to understand it is there before you can withdraw?
Well, if it's very hidden, yeah, and you, like, let's say something which is very repressed and one doesn't even know one is functioning from fear, it has to be made conscious, right? But I don't think one, like for me, where... I mean, first of all, I had to be conscious that there were fears and so on, and my reaction to the fears. So I had to understand that mechanism. But I don't feel I had to understand where those fears came from, in that sense. I didn't feel I had to go into a whole bunch of analytical thought about my childhood. Although I had some ideas and so on, But I, what I needed to, for me, what I needed to see is the mechanism in the moment rather than a historical perspective. And so for me, where I had to understand the desire around fear, and that was one of the big things I've worked through and am working through, is the desire around the fear. So it was the fear of the fear, and that took me a long time to see. So I do practices to get rid of the fear, to, you know, welcome it, but always behind it was the desire to get rid of the fear. And that just struggle with it, and looking at it, and getting to know it took quite a bit of time until I became really kind of conversant with it. But that was a very existential, immediate kind of investigation rather than an analytical, intellectual thing. Thought was there, but it was more like, what is the feeling? What is the problem here? And I keep looking at it, and then looking in a very more of a silent way. Because the fear is deeper than just my thoughts. And the aversion to the fear and the fear of the fear, you know, very complicated. And so then for me to understand that desire, I had to be willing to be with it day in and day out, day in and day out for, you know, a long time. Until I think its power began to recede and I understood it much more physically probably. Yes, so there's a real exercise there. But I would, for me, I emphasize that it was not just an intellectual idea about it. You know, it was around moment-by-moment awareness and understanding it. So then when situations, if I'm talking about fear, that triggered the fear came up, then I'd always try to say, okay, good. You know, at some level, I'd try to see the positive aspect. Okay, now you can learn about fear again. It's here again. And then there was the looking, and it's just watching what happens. Yeah? But if a person has, you know, had some kind of deep trauma in life, you know, and then at 30 years old they're not even aware where their fears are coming from, then there has to be some kind of methods of making that conscious for the person. Analysis or dream, I don't know what, but because as long as you can't be conscious, you can't really work with it. So in Buddhism, that's the sort of consciousness is the escape hatch. Things have to be conscious. They have to be on the surface. Any other bits? You wouldn't. Well, simply when the mind is not thinking, you can take it in coarse ways, like put your hand on ice. This isn't quite ice, but it's, and then there's the suchness of that experience, right? So usually you notice it in kind of extreme things, but how can I communicate it? It's just life. experience is not communicable, is it? But you touch it in nature, you know, when the mind just isn't creating anything. I do it a lot with sound, and I do that all the time in nature. I continue like I just really listen to bird sound. It's experience, yeah, without the filter of commentary. I just read a nice bit of poetry from Wendell Berry, yeah. The best of song is bird song in the quiet. But first, you must have the quiet. And he's an ecologist, so he's talking in this kind of two ways there. So to really hear the red-winged blackbird, you have to give the space in consciousness for that to come in. If the mind is always like in the future or past, that's the best way to look at it, maybe. Going somewhere, trying to, you're not really, there is no space available. Yeah.
And then the analogy which occurred to me is at the end of experiencing in nature, and I remember very vividly walking through the mountains with a friend, and I was just enjoying the experience, the listening, the seeing, and bringing it all in. And my friend was spending, and enjoying the birds, my friend was spending all his time looking at the birds and saying, that is a such and such, and looking in his book and trying to figure out what kind of a bird it was, so he could add it into the log, etc., the number of birds. You know, it's a very different way of experiencing and intellectualizing. So,
yeah, thought is not the same. Thought is always a removed from the experience. So the description of fear is not fear. The description of yellow is not yellow. Artists are good at that, aren't they? Where they can just kind of really be open to color or whatever. So whatever whatever bits of your senses can do that, whether it's with sound or with sight, tactile things, cold things, You can train in really simple ways like that. You know, you just take a snowball, no more snow, and just hold it in your hand for a bit, and just experience cold without comment. And then when you go into nature, if the wind is blowing, running, oh, wind's blowing, and the wind is blowing, and you know, you kind of continue training in a very beautiful way with nature. Then all that training, of course, clicks in with the difficult bits like loneliness or fear, or whatever. And there's so much more beauty in life, actually.
Even as she said, looking at the birds and looking up in the book, and then that's also being in the present moment.
Yeah, that can be skillful, in the sense that, like, information can let you see more refined aspects. So, like a birder, you know, sees. Like if I'm looking at the difference between a mallard and a shoveler, it's got a different. What do ducks have? They don't have beaks, do they? Do they have beaks? Okay, ducks have beaks. Bills, thank you. So, you know, you look at the book, and then you look more closely, oh yeah, the shoveler has a bigger bill. So that can refine your attention, information. But I think what we're pointing to is the continually thinking about an experience. So information, you can do that as a present experience. You can read, you can study, fine. But what I'm kind of pointing to is just the endless kind of tripping out, judging, analyzing, doubting, you know, just endless kind of mind trips that we get into, rather than the skillful use of study and discrimination. That can be fine. It can be skillful or unskillful. So like birders, you get like some birders are kind of knocking off the list, you know? And you get some who really, okay, they look and they really are with the animal. It depends how you use it. I'm a birder.
Can temperament hinder? You know, some people are very enthusiastic and much comment on everything by nature. Whereas another temperament, like
well, in some sense, we're all working with temperament, you know, in some way or other. And we're not going to change our temperaments per se, but those bits of our temperament which have gone a bit astray into unskillful attitudes will cause us suffering. So the extrovert and the introvert are different types. They're like the great teachers in Thailand, Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Mahabua. So Ajahn Chah or Ajahn Buddhadasa, the two great teachers, right? And one is very intellectual. Always had notes when he gave lecture, and he kind of gave lectures and so on. Ajahn Chah talked about mangoes. You know, so you had a different kind of charisma and different kind of energy. And they were their own people, but the deep silence that was behind all that, you could see that their temperament wasn't driven by fear or desire, right? So that I think that's important to see that we don't have to clone ourselves into some kind of Buddha, right? That we have to be authentic to our own, the way we are the way our personalities manifest, that's fine. But can personality manifest according to time and place rather than according to greed and desire? So can personality manifest according to a situation, and can it be quiet when it's not necessary? And that's one of the things I saw with my teacher, where he could, you know, we'd be sitting around in kind of satsang situation, and there'd be no questions, and maybe five or six people just sitting there. And you look at him, you see there's no one there. And then a merchant would come, and all of a sudden he'd just come alive, full of charm, full of charisma, drawing the person in, encouraging them or reprimanding them, whatever he had to do. The merchant would leave. There's no one there. Really is. Ooh. And what was lovely about that, you could see that the personality could manifest from a situation rather than from a compulsion. See what I mean? So if the exuberant temperament is a compulsion of workaholism, or, you know, it's probably coming from maybe fear or something. And the introvert is just always kind of inverted because they're depressed. So it's not so much about personality. It's, again, it's the underlying core of our, you know, where we're coming from.
But in his case, is it through training?
I mean, he really trained his mind to be profoundly silent. And yet he could be profoundly charming. But you could see there, he didn't need anything from anyone. So he could give a lot, but also one of the things around his teacher was he was fearless. So he could keep, you know, he could keep talking for 3 hours with 50 monks hating his guts. You know, just rabbiting on. You know, and everyone's kind of lost it within an hour. And he knows it. And he's just going on and on. The mosquitoes are biting, and the concrete's, you know, kind of, and everyone hates his guts. You know, I mean. And he says, blah, 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 blah. Why do you suffer? Blah, 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 blah. Suffering is caused by blah, blah, blah. You know, and then, blah, blah, blah. And you could see, you know, he could manifest that because he was fearless. He didn't need the praise of his students. Hate me, fine, it's your problem. And yet he never did it from cruelty. You know, he could draw someone in and encourage them and so on. So he had all these kind of lovely facets of personality, but you just sensed that it wasn't coming from the usual kind of ego needs. So it was literally a free personality in that sense. Pick it up, put it down. And hence he could teach Westerners, complicated Westerners with our complicated mindset.